Okay, Didactic Mind, episode 36, Lessons from Abject Failures. Very warm welcome to everybody listening in via SoundCloud or from the blog. Very warm welcome to all of my loyal readers and to everyone who has subscribed to my podcast. If you have not subscribed, of course, please make sure you hit that subscribe button. That way you will never ever miss a new upload. And today I basically wanted to talk about a kind of a topic that's been on my mind for a while now. Basically, this was sort of a response to a comment left a while back. This was from like 20th of June or thereabouts, where a commenter named Jeff left a comment about a video that I put into a post where the video explained why most people will remain in mediocrity. And the point of that video was that most people will be mediocre all their lives because they're afraid to fail, and they're afraid to put themselves out there and be shot down and be exposed to the world. And because of that, they will always strive for the safety of the herd. But by definition, if you strive for the safety of the herd, you will never ever actually do anything that is not what the herd approves of and wants. So I wanted to address that because Jeff himself asked, essentially, I would have liked to see this video through the eyes of a Christian. That's the only thing that would have made it better. So with that in mind, let's talk, or I will talk a bit about what it means to be a colossal and complete failure, and how you can bounce back from that, and what those failures mean from a Christian perspective. So, I'm not kidding about colossal and complete failures. I have failed on more levels than most people will ever achieve in a lifetime. Thank your lucky stars if you haven't been in my position. Because I have failed on a number of levels so spectacularly and so badly that I'm not sure anyone should ever look upon me as any kind of role model. And I make that very clear in my writings and my podcasts. Don't look to me as somebody to follow, because I'm not. I'm not a good example of someone to pay attention to without some serious vetting. It's not a good idea to listen to anything that I have to say unless you're willing to do some of your own homework and figure out whether what I'm saying actually makes sense. So what do I mean by my failures? Well, if you've listened to my earlier podcasts, you will know from the very first couple of podcasts, I explained my background and my sort of evolution over the years. I was educated in the UK. Well, actually, I mean, I've lived in, what, seven countries by now, because I've lived in Russia for close to a year, if you add up all the time I've spent. But I basically lived in Asia and the West and now Russia for my entire life. So I went to school in Australia, Singapore, the UK, the US, and ended up living in the US for nigh on 12 years. Just shy of 12 years, in fact. And you would think that if you'd spent that much time in the US, you would have US citizenship after 12 years. Well, no, that's not the case because of the rather unique way in which the US immigration system works. So I have always called the opportunity to live and work in the US a winning lottery ticket in life. And it really angers me, by the way, when people don't treat it that way, when illegal immigrants just come in and treat the US like crap and treat the people of the US like crap and just assume that they should be given things just for showing up. I don't agree with that at all in any way. It's one of the reasons why I am so thoroughly against illegal immigration. I mean, most guys I know are against illegal immigration. I am of I am, but they think of it in the abstract. You know, it's just wrong for people to break the laws and be rewarded. I'm of a completely different level. I mean, I am of the level where, as far as I am concerned, the United States has every right to shoot people trying to cross in illegally at the border and leave their bodies in the desert to rot. And as far as I'm concerned, that's not only a rational reaction to illegal immigration, that's a totally justified reaction. It's one that is used by other countries around the world. I mean, in India, for instance, they have a 250,000 strong border patrol force that patrols along the Pakistani and Bangladeshi borders. And those borders are manned by people with the authority to shoot to kill. And they are very happy to use that authority. You will find pictures in Indian media of those border guards kind of basically standing over the corpses of gangsters and smugglers and illegals that they've shot. And rightly so. India has every right to defend its borders. So does the USA. And if you don't like that, you can just sod off. You can go back to where you came from. Don't live in the US. Don't live in a Western country. Go back to where you came from. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, mass deportations are very much in order in most of the West. Most of the people who went there, who now espouse anti-Western, anti-American, anti-British, anti-European values, need to be deported back to their countries of origin and need to be kept there. They should not be allowed back in ever again. But that aside, you know, my views on immigration are a product of my time spent in the US, and a product of the time spent dealing with the US immigration system, which was miserable. But I should have taken advantage of my time there. You know, that was probably my biggest failure ever, because I failed to trade a useless passport, and it is a useless passport, for one of the world's best passports. Contrary to what Americans might think today, the US passport is not the best in the world. It's well, if you look at the, you know, Global Passport Index, the US ranks well below a number of countries in terms of the power of its passport. The most powerful passport in the world right now is Japan, followed by New Zealand. And if you look at the USA, it actually ranks below the UK right now. It ranks, oh, I don't know, where is the US? Somewhere around, bugger. It's 19th. I'm serious. It's 19th. It ranks below North Macedonia. It ranks below the UAE. It ranks below Ukraine, of all countries. Ukraine has the 11th most powerful passport in the world. When you assess powerful, what that means is, you know, number of countries where you get visa-free or relatively easy visa access, visa on arrival, basically. So you don't require too many visas to travel around. The US has the 19th most powerful passport, but that's still a hell of a lot more powerful than the country where I come from, which has a rank of, oh, I don't know, something like, I think it's 70th or 80th, something around that. Because basically, that country requires a visa for everywhere. You know, you basically have to get, if you have that country's passport, you need a visa for everything, more or less. Yeah, it's actually 53rd. You compare that with Russia. I mean, Russia has a passport rank of 25, so they're doing pretty well. That was the single biggest mistake I ever made, of not getting a better passport throughout my travels. Now, while I was a young adult, you know, when I was, let's say, below the age of 21, 22, I couldn't do much about it, but beyond that, yeah, I should have. Some amount of the blame must be apportioned to family circumstances, and I'm not going to go into that in any detail, but the majority of the blame is mine. I definitely failed to get a better passport, and that meant that when the time came, I had to leave the US and go to a country and a part of the world where I don't understand anything about it. I don't pretend to be from there. It's not my culture, it's not my country, it's they're not my tribe. I just happen to have a passport that says I'm from there, when in reality I am not. So that is a spectacular failure and a terrible one. Every single job I've held, I've lost. the first three were because of layoffs, every single time. And the fourth was basically because the project that I was supposed to be attached to, which might have gotten me a work permit to work in East Asia, never materialized because the product that I was doing in kind of an exploratory analysis on turned out to be way too stupid and complicated and expensive to justify the expenditure. It was a Microsoft product, by the way. I wasn't working for Microsoft, let me make this clear. I was working with a Microsoft product for a client. And as usual, Microsoft doesn't do what they say they're going to do. And that's to be expected because Microsoft these days is an Indian software company, and when you hire H1B Indian coders, you get H1B quality Indian code, which is a big part of the reason why Microsoft Office sucks, why Microsoft Windows is appalling abomination, why even the Xbox isn't as good as it could. Like, I'm not talking about the hardware. The hardware for the Xbox is great. The software is middling so-so. And why Skype is just everybody I know who uses Skype hates it, but we're stuck using it. It's just a terrible product. And there's a story of, the founder of Skype, who sold his company, I think, 2005 to Microsoft. he keeps getting asked by irate users at tech conferences, like, what the hell did you do with Skype? It used to work great and now it's terrible. And he's like, he keeps telling people, look, don't look at me. It was working great when I was running things. It's not my fault. I don't have anything to do with Skype anymore. It's not my fault. And it's not. It's not his fault. It's Microsoft's fault. It's because Microsoft is just such a terrible, terrible company right now. And they've just been playing catch up for so long in so many different areas. They have almost no original ideas that they can call their own that are truly successful, other than the Xbox, the .NET framework, and now I will concede that they do have a very strong presence on the cloud. But they're still way behind Amazon Web Services and Google Cloud, whatever their offering is. So anyway, I have failed at securing a better passport, which, is something that I have to live with now for the next 10 years until I finally get something better and can get rid of my current useless citizenship. And that opens up a whole, Pandora's box of questions about, okay, well, which tribe do you really belong to? Are you really a citizen of what, country X? Will you stand and fight to defend country X? Yeah, granted. I mean, I am, there is a distinct contradiction between the values that I espouse about nationalism and nationality and tribe and blood, and the desire to get out of all of that and get something else. I get that. Look, I am, you are more than welcome to criticize me for being a hypocrite, and I will accept those criticisms. That's the way it is, right? When you're born and raised into a tribe all your life, you have distinctly different feelings about that tribe than if you just happen to be born on the land and then left it before you formed any attachments to it and skipped around the globe for the next 25, 35 years, basically, and never really formed any strong attachments to that group of people, and then saw, all those bonds kind of destroyed over time due to family stuff, which I'm certainly not going to go into here. But that's the nature of things. That's the reality that you have to live with. I mean, sooner or later, everyone's going to have to decide which tribe he belongs to, right? And just tangentially, let me address this very quickly. racism is not a sin. We keep being told racism is a terrible sin. It's not. Nowhere in the Bible is racism ever mentioned even once as a sin. It is absolutely ridiculous to argue that racism is sinful. It's not. Xenophobia is a survival instinct. It has been a survival instinct since the dawn of man. It will always be a survival instinct. Anyone who argues that you cannot judge people by the color of their skin is lying. Anyone who says he is colorblind is lying. Anyone who says that he judges people on their individual merits while taking into account the realities of race is probably telling the truth. Anyone who says that I will judge a black person based on what I think of him, you know, when I meet him in the street and we have a conversation, I get a feel for who he is, and I will judge him based on that, okay, that's part of the truth, but you're also judging him based on the color of his skin. Likewise, anyone who meets a Chinese person in the street, talks to that person, judges him by the content of that conversation, the content of the man's character, he's partly telling the truth, but make no mistake, there is no question skin color plays a part, okay? And let me also add, tangentially, the least racist people on this planet are white people. And I'm saying that with more than 30 years worth of experience and benefit of hindsight. The absolute least racist people on the planet are white people. I have lived in Australia around white people who have a very, very sharp and pointed sense of humor. And they have no problems with, or they had no problems, you know, 20 years ago when I lived there, they had no problems with sledging people on the basis of skin color. It was accepted. It was normal. Either you grew a thick skin and you dealt with it, or you became a whiny little crybaby snowflake and you went running to mom and dad and told them, you know, the big boys are being mean to me. Well, so what? I have lived in Russia, which is very white and very hostile to outsiders who don't conform to their norms. Not once in almost a year of living in Russia, all told, you know, stringing together all the time I've spent here in Russia itself, not once have I ever felt as though I was being discriminated against based on the color of my skin. I've been called some interesting names. Chingachgook was one of the more interesting ones. That was indirect. And I thought it was a big joke. I thought it was really funny, and it was accepted as a joke between, you know, the people I was with and the guy who made the joke. It was a security guard at a restaurant, and we all thought it was really funny. And I maintain it was very funny. That is the nature of white people. White people are not racist, by and large. I have never experienced real racism at the hands of white people. I have experienced real racism at the hands of Chinese people. Very real racism. I have experienced real racism at the hands of Indians and black people. So I do not believe for a moment that white people have any obligation whatsoever to pay attention to this nonsense idea that they are racist. They're not. And if white people continue to believe this lie, that they are the most racist people on earth, that's idiotic. They should stop paying any attention to it. They should simply ignore the people who say it, or, better yet, just deport their asses. Just get rid of them and solve the problem that way. So, you know, as I said, somewhat digression from into a different topic. But coming back to this issue of failure and failing hard, well, as I said, I have failed both on the job front and on the passport front. Where else have I failed? I have failed on the health front. While my health overall is very good, I am a very long way away from what I used to be capable of doing. 3 years ago, you know, I had trained back in, 2017, thereabouts, no, 2016. So 4 years ago now. I trained on I achieved my green belt in Krav Maga on an extraordinarily hot, bloody, brutally, murderously hot summer day in New York City. And, you know, a year later I was squatting 350 pounds with a belt and knee sleeves, so basically raw. I was deadlifting 460 455 pounds. I was benching 235. These are all achievements that I'm very, very proud of, and they are strength achievements that they're not that impressive compared to what a lot of guys my age and size can do. But for somebody with my genetics and my family background, that's amazing. I'm the only person in my entire extended family. I'm not just talking about, you know, my immediate family, but like cousins and aunts and uncles and other people of that milieu or generation. I'm the only one who bothers to lift and exercise regularly. But fast forward 3-4 years, I know, because I've had MRI scans done now, that just about every single vertebra in my lower back is bulging out. Like the intravertebral discs in my lower back are all bulging. They're not herniated. There's a difference. They're not herniated. They're not collapsed. Nothing like that. They're not ruptured. But they're bulging. And that's the classic sign of bad lifting technique and bad posture. And I recently filmed myself doing squats, and I compared the footage from those squats that I did like a week or two ago against squats that I did 275 pounds with a belt, you know, from, I don't know, about 6-7 years back. I was horrified at how badly my form had collapsed. And I don't know exactly why, but I have some good ideas as to where it all started, so I'm making some adjustments. But it was just appalling. I was like, holy shit, I mean, I have completely screwed up my form. I need to stop doing low barbell back squats, and I need to completely reassess my training methods, and I need to change the way I'm doing things and change my approach. And if I don't do that, I could seriously injure myself, because, you know, I'm getting into the hole and I'm not even actually going to parallel. I mean, previously on my previous video, I was going right down below parallel, no problems, back was straight, everything looked good, the bar was steady on my back. Here, these days, my upper back actually collapses forward slightly, because I'm trying to lean into, I'm not trying to descend into the hole, I'm actually leaning down. And that's a classic indication of tight quads, or weak quads, rather. So there's clearly some muscular imbalances which have developed, because, you know, the low barbell back squat is hamstring and glute dominant. The high bar and front barbell squats are quad dominant. So that indicates very clearly I need to switch to quad dominant exercises before I switch back to barbell back squats. And it indicates that I have weak hip flexors. You know, I have damage all over my body from just mostly from martial arts. There's only like one or two injuries that are truly due, that can truly genuinely be put down to weightlifting. And one of those injuries is a wrecked left shoulder. And that's got nothing to do with barbell exercises. It has everything to do with using a Smith machine from like nine and a half years ago. So I have failed on that front. I have failed romantically, you know, on multiple levels, on so many different levels. It's not even funny. I won't go into those failures here, but they are pretty severe. I mean, I was unable to maintain any kind of relationship for a very, very long time. And I just given up on any kind of relationship with a woman for years at a stretch. And when things finally came to a head and I had to leave the USA, I had to get out, I had no choice, that it was only then that I was able to break that curse and get that monkey off my back, as it were, and finally have a relationship. And even then, that's not been easy. It is difficult to do those things in the situation that I'm in. You know, that's another source of failure. If you look at the kind of the span of my life, it's just one long series of failures, one after another. So how do you kind of get past that? How does someone who has failed so thoroughly, so repeatedly, so completely, in every possible way, carry on? And I'm not joking about completely, thoroughly, etc. I have failed as a son. I have failed as a member of my tribe, if you want to call it that. I have failed to live up to the expectations of that tribe. I have failed as a brother, on a number of occasions. I have failed as a professional. I have failed in my romantic relationships. I have failed as a child of God, as a Christian. I have failed as any kind of athlete or martial artist. I'm not either of those things, but I can legitimately spar and I know some fighting techniques. I wanted to carry on doing that, but I haven't had the opportunity. So, with all of those failures stacked up against you, what do you do? The answer is you just keep going. You have to take those failures as learning experiences. And that's really hard to do. The biblical approach to this, or the biblical kind of, I don't know what you would call it, the biblical wisdom, if you will, with respect to failures, comes from the New Testament, unsurprisingly, and it comes from James chapter 1. So let's read through it. James chapter 1, the letter of James to whoever, to the 12 tribes. So this is the section called Testing of Your Faith. I'm excerpting here from the English Standard Version. If you prefer a different translation of the Bible, then by all means, use whichever translation you want. Just don't use the Scofield Bible because that is genuinely heretical, and a very wrong-headed translation. The good old King James, the New King James, the American Standard, the New International. I don't much like the New International myself. I think it sacrifices a lot of the beauty of the prose. My personal preference is the English Standard Version. So, reading through James chapter 1, starting at verse 2, testing your faith. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. But let him ask in faith, with no doubting, for the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. Let the lowly brother pass boast in his exaltation, and the rich in his humiliation, because like a flower of the grass, he will pass away. For the sun rises with its scorching heat and withers the grass, and its flower falls and its beauty perishes. So will the rich man fade away in the midst of his pursuits. Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life which God has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, "I am being tempted by God." For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brothers. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. Of his own will he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. That, in summary, is the Christian approach to dealing with failure. As hard as it is, and it is enormously hard to accept this teaching. Believe me, I know. I mean, I was bitching and moaning and complaining a few weeks ago to a friend of mine about some very, very difficult personal stuff I was going through. And he basically said to me, and he's a reader of mine. He's actually the guy that brought me to Christ, to be very honest. And he's the man who kind of spent hours with me on the phone when I was in the States after I left. You know, we talk, you know, once a month at least. And it's basically he's a, if you think I'm a talkative motor mouth chap, you've never met me. Most of you haven't anyway. And you have no idea that in person I'm actually pretty slow speaking and soft spoken. And this guy is just a motor mouth. He just, at least with people he trusts, he will just go on and on and on for hours if you let him. And most of our conversations just involve me asking him a question and listening for 20 minutes while he gets through everything that's in his mind about the answer. And those conversations go on for 2 hours at a stretch. But he told me about this particular passage and a few others in the Bible, talking about testing and about being grateful for your tests. This teaching needs to be married, or I should say, partnered with some of the Stoic teachings on how to deal with failure. Stoicism teaches us that you should enjoy the small things in life, and more importantly, you should be grateful for what you have in your life. Because when you are grateful for what you have, you automatically appreciate something that you get even more. So that's how you respond to failure. That's how you get over the fear of failing. That's how you move away from this crippling fear that so many of us have. I have it, most people have it, of falling flat on your ass and making a fool of yourself. And you never really get over it, I don't think. I don't think anybody ever really gets over that fear of failing catastrophically and cataclysmically, and, you know, to the point where you can never recover. But look at it another way. The worst that can happen is that you die. Okay? That's pretty horrible. But you're going to die anyway. Someday you'll be dead. If that's the worst that can happen, and everybody, no matter, you know, how much people say it's good to be around your friends and loved ones when you shuffle off this mortal coil and all, the truth is, everyone dies alone and in pain. Everyone. Whether you die in your sleep, or you die in a hospital bed, or you die screaming in a trench, or on a battlefield somewhere, or in a cage, or in a ring, fighting somebody else, you die alone and in terrible pain. Okay? You'll be lucky if you die in your sleep and you show no outward signs of pain, but ultimately you will die. The approach up to your death will be painful. If that's the worst that can happen, is your death, what's the next worst thing that can happen? Complete and total humiliation. Okay, that's pretty awful. But at least you can recover from that because it's not as bad as dying. At least you can find a way out of that. So if you fail, the key is to accept your failure as quickly as possible. The classic example that I give of this is in a post on my blog called The Dominator Mindset. And it concerns a man named Dominic Cruz, who's one of my favorite fighters in the UFC. Now, Dominic Cruz is an incredible martial artist. He's an incredible athlete. He has the most awkward, uncomfortable-looking, weird fighting style that I've ever seen of any fighter. I mean, he's constantly switching stances. He moves with his hands down. He has this weird sort of shuffling walk. He's just moving all the time. He's impossible to pin down. If you watch TJ Dillashaw and Cody Garbrandt. I mean, TJ before he popped for EPO and was banned for 2 years, and Cody before he got his mollywopped twice by TJ. If you watch those fighters and the way they move, that's exactly what you see with Dominic Cruz. He's the guy who popularized that style of fighting, of constantly shifting in and out, moving, you know, switching angles, cutting to the side, moving with his hands down, striking from unpredictable places, taking down his opponents with, you know, bursts of speed and all that. He's a crazy talented fighter, and he's also an incredibly gifted color commentator. I mean, he provides a level of technical expertise and appreciation of the fighting art that nobody else can do. No one else has that level of insight and precision. You know, not Michael Bisping, not Daniel Cormier, not Kevin, what's his name? Bolt, I've forgotten his name. Nobody else provides it. Even Bas Rutten doesn't provide that level of analysis and insight and detail and experience and wisdom. But if you look at Dominic's fighting career, he's actually had a really difficult time with his career because he's just been injured so many times. I mean, he was on top of the world. He was the undisputed bantamweight champion of the world. And then he was due to defend his title against Renan Barao, who eventually took it from him. But he never lost it in the cage up until that point. He was sidelined with a massive injury to his ACL. He tore his ACL, and then he had to have like three different surgeries for that ACL. He was sidelined for 2 years. He had another groin injury during that time. He came back after getting grafted ACL reconstruction on his knee, and then he came back and just absolutely beat the shit out of Takeya Mizugaki, who was a rising star in the division at the time. Just absolutely destroyed him in a single round. And then he looked like he was doing well, and then kabam, you know, the ACL in his right knee popped. So he had to go through another reconstructive surgery. He was out for 9 months, and then he came back and he just edged TJ Dillashaw in an incredibly thin split decision. Then he defended his belt against Uriah Faber, beat the crap out of him, and it completely dominated that fight from start to finish. And then, you know, lost his belt to Cody Garbrandt, and then was supposed to rematch Cody, but he broke his arm in training. And, you know, he's been out of, he basically hadn't fought, I think, up until sometime last year. He hadn't fought for like 3-4 years, something like that. 3 years at least. And finally he came back and he lost to Henry Cejudo in a ridiculous, you know, stoppage. He looked like he was fine, but the ref jumped in and called the fight. And yeah, I mean, it was stupid, but what are you going to do? That is a guy who has failed on so many levels, and yet he keeps coming back. And he talks about it in a Joe Rogan interview, where he basically talks about how being away from the fight game for so long let him appreciate what it's like to be retired. And he now understands what makes him happy, and he understands what he wants in life. So those failures actually helped test him and cement him into the man that he is. So to the point where he doesn't need to win constantly to be happy. He just needs to know what he can accomplish, and he just needs to go out and get it. And that's the same thing that the message in the Bible keeps telling us, except at an even deeper level. The message in the Bible keeps saying, try to ask what is God's will for you, and you're not necessarily going to like the answer. My friend who I was talking about earlier told me something, which he said, do not forget these words. What God wants for you is often diametrically 180 degrees opposed to what you want for yourself. And he's going to arrange things in ways that you're not going to like if you decide to become one of his own. You're really not going to like where he puts you sometimes. You're really going to hate it. You're going to ask, Lord, why am I being tested this way? Why am I being forced to suffer like this? Why am I going through this misery? I mean, I've asked that question so many times by now, it's not even funny. And the answer is always going to be, ultimately, you're doing something that I need you to do. And it's never going to be phrased in, you know, that direct a way. It's never going to come through like that. You're enduring this because you need it. You need to go through this testing process. You need to experience this. You need to suffer through this because you have to endure. You have to be torn down and rebuilt from the ground up. It's like with forging a sword. There's a myth among sort of weapons aficionados that samurai swords are folded over, you know, the metal is folded like 1,000 times to create the incredible high carbon steel coating and the signature sharpness of the samurai blade. That's bullshit. That doesn't happen. The reality of metallurgy is that you can only fold steel a certain number of times on itself until the lump of metal that you're working with actually loses all of its form and properties and just becomes useless. So when it comes to the actual process of forging a blade, you can only fold it over about 10, 15 times, something like that. I may be wrong about the exact number. But the way that a samurai sword is made is that you have a core of low-carbon steel, which is very strong but does not retain an edge. And then around that core is jacketed the high-carbon steel blade. That's how they're made. And the two are then fused together and placed on the hilt. And that is exactly where the samurai swords get their legendary lightness, sharpness, and flexibility. Or not flexibility, but their strength. Samurai swords are not actually particularly flexible. You can snap a samurai sword pretty easily. Even a high-quality samurai sword, you can snap it just by smashing it into another sword. Or another like a steel block or something like that. You can snap a samurai blade pretty easily. It's not that hard to do. These swords are not the kind of Spanish steel that you could actually bend over. You know, there are Spanish swords from the golden age of sword making, which you could actually bend over on themselves, and they would still be fabulously sharp, retain an incredible edge, and be very resistant to damage. But the point of all that is that the swords have to be forged in a very particular way. It's not easy to make these blades. And the swordsmiths who make them have to work with material that may not necessarily want to be worked upon, may not necessarily be malleable enough. So if they make a mistake, or if they temper it and the material is unable to stand up to what they're trying to do, they have to start all over again. They have to remake the material. They have to smelt it down all over again. They have to forge the sword again. You know, making a fine Japanese sword is an art form as much as it is a science. And it is an extremely difficult art form. So when you finally get it all together and you get a sword that truly works, you get a sword that is truly sharp and functional, then it's an incredible achievement. That's what God is trying to do with each and every one of us. He's trying to forge us into an instrument of his will, and he has to use broken tools to do it. We are all broken, every single one of us. So when you look at the message of that video, and you know, all the links will be in the description box, you can follow up on all of this yourself with ease, you will see that the video itself points out that you have to be willing to fail. You have to be willing to put yourself out there and fail. So, and you have to be willing to learn from your lessons. You have to be willing to learn the lessons of those failures. And if you don't learn the lessons, then it's a wasted effort. You fail and you will keep failing until such time as you change your approach. The example that the guy gives is of, you know, being afraid of mean comments to his posts. And he was so terrified of criticism that he made very anodyne, boring posts for the next like couple of years until he finally got up the courage to write something edgy. And it's only when he overcame his fear of failing in that respect that he began to really experience a resurgence in blog traffic, and he became a really good writer. In my case, that was never a problem. I was never afraid of mean comments. I was just like, yeah, you know what, I'm going to write. If you don't like what I write, bugger off. And I've been writing for 7.5 years now, so and people actually read what I write. They're interested in what I write, so plainly I'm doing something right. But, you know, for the longest time, like, I was held back by the fear of failing in any commercial venture. I should have launched a website of my own, like, on my own hosted platform, on selling products that I am interested in, that I believe in, years ago. I just launched a shaving website a couple of weeks back. And I finally made, you know, I made my first sale. I've written 2 posts on the entire website. I spent a lot of time and effort putting it all together and putting the products together. I'm not claiming it's a professionally done website. It's not. But I made a sale. Holy crap. I can actually do this now. I can potentially make a business out of this. Wow. Okay. You know, if I was still stuck in that mode of being afraid of failing, I never would have done this stuff. I never would have experienced the rush that comes from making a sale. It's not even a big sale. I get like $1 out of it, literally $1 out of that sale in terms of commissions. That's it. But that's the first one, and that's how you build from there. I mean, you've achieved one landmark. You know, you sold something for $1. Okay, now let's make that. Let's see if I can turn it into $10. Okay. Now let's see if I can turn it into $100. Okay. Now let me see if I can turn this into $1,000. Okay. Now let me see if I can turn it into $1,000 a month. Oh, okay. Now let me see if I can turn it into $5,000 a month. Huh, all right. Now let me see if I can turn this into a business where I don't have to do very much of anything. I can outsource a lot of the work to competent writers and skilled people and just bugger off and, you know, enjoy the profits of some, you know, other people's labors, farm out the labor and collect rent or royalties or whatever. Become a business owner, become an investor, become whatever. Spend the rest of your days hanging out in Eastern Europe and you know, drinking lattes and enjoying the scenery. And by scenery, I do mean, yes, not just the beautiful buildings, but the beautiful ladies walking past in summer dresses. I strongly maintain that if you have not been to a gym in Moscow or Nizhny Novgorod or St. Petersburg or Kiev or Warsaw for that matter at peak hour, you have not lived. And if you disagree with my assertion, I will gladly invite you to come to Moscow with me the next time I go on a trip. And I will take you to a gym that I know of in southern Moscow, where I was and am a member right now. And I will take you there at about 7 o'clock in the evening, and you can test my assertion. And I'll happily bet you $20, and I'll win. And it'll be a lot of fun to look at your face and see you just looking around, you know, doing the full on Linda Blair head spinning in The Exorcist sort of move. It'll be hilarious because that's exactly what it's like. I think the other key lesson from that video that I mentioned in my post is that you kind of have to be willing to accept harsh truths. I mean, not kind of have to, you have to be willing to accept harsh truths. And the good thing about failure is that it makes you more receptive to harsh truths. You have to have your pride beaten down. You have to be humbled and humiliated. You have to be exposed to some brutal, brutal insights into your own shortcomings before you realize where you've gone wrong. And it's always a very unpleasant process, extraordinarily unpleasant. Nobody enjoys it. Nobody should enjoy it. Nobody should think that it's a good idea, that it's a fun thing to do. Richard Grannan, who is a an interesting character, go look him up on YouTube. I'll put a link to his channel in the description box. Talks about psychology and philosophy. Now, normally I have very little respect for psychology. I mean, I have more respect than I used to. Since in the last couple of years, I've developed both more and less respect for psychology as time's gone by. I accept that psychology works in some ways, but overall, I think the people who trust in psychology as a way to fix their problems are really quite deluded and have not assessed whether or not that's a good idea. But anyway, Richard Grannan talks about how psychology is actually a branch of philosophy, and what will save you in the dark times is having a solid philosophy to act as your anchor, your base. He's not wrong. He's not. He's 100% correct about this, and he picks and chooses all sorts of cool stuff from, from Taoism, Buddhism, Chinese philosophy about yin and yang, Stoicism in particular, and he weaves it all together into a philosophical framework which says that the true distinction in our world today is not between alpha and beta, or red pill and blue pill, or man and woman, or even yin and yang. It's about adult and child. Adult, child. An adult is capable of looking at things logically and dispassionately and not allowing emotion to rule over him. Most people in this world are not adults. Most people in this world are children, just pathetic, whiny, whimpering, scared, frightened little children. I count myself as one of them. I do not claim to be a fully developed adult, even though I'm in my mid-30s. I have a lot of lessons that I have to learn. They're very miserable, they're very painful. I do not claim to be an adult in a lot of ways. There are plenty of times when I prefer my own comfort, my own way of doing things, my own comfort zone to trying something new, taking a risk, risking failure, risking humiliation, but just trying something for the sake of trying it. And that has been a problem all my life. I will even go so far as to say that is a serious problem of the Asian mindset. I come from an Asian background, and I will tell you that Asians have a massive problem with this, and it's one of the things that holds back both South and East Asian culture. It's a huge issue, and no Asian country that I've ever seen has managed to get past it. But that's for another day, I think. The distinction between adult and child lies in understanding that you will fail, you will be humiliated, you will be broken, but you need to go through that. As miserable and as painful as it's going to be, you have to go through it, you have to suffer through it. Just grit your teeth, get it over with, learn the lessons. And when you've learned the lessons, thank God for your tests, because that's the key part that Richard Grannan misses. He's not, as far as I can tell, a Christian. He doesn't have a Christian worldview. Christianity is the only faith anywhere on earth that offers a true explanation for the problem of evil and offers a solution. Hinduism cannot make this claim. It is why I have very little, it's one of the reasons why I have very little respect for Hinduism as a religion. Islam is nothing more than an appalling heresy of Christianity, a very evil one. Judaism, as we understand it today, is insufficient to the task. even though it spawned Christianity, modern Judaism has very little of anything to do with Old Testament Judaism as we understand it. Buddhism basically says it's all an illusion, so don't bother. None of the other major faiths are capable of offering an explanation to the problem of evil. And when you go through these failures, when you go through this pain, when you go through this misery, you're going to experience what it's like to be subjected to evil. And you're going to need a way to fight that evil off. There's only one way. There is only one way. Atheism can't do it for you because I speak as a former atheist. Atheists are the people who are most obsessed with God out of anybody. They are so obsessed with proving that God doesn't exist that inevitably they end up making complete fools of themselves, which they've done for, you know, decades, centuries now. Atheism offers no solutions whatsoever. Stoicism comes very, very close. Stoicism, with its kind of grin and bear it philosophy, with its appreciation of the little things in life, with its attitude of gratitude for what you have in life and what you have received in life, is a very good alternative. But it's not sufficient. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient. So when those failures come, pick yourself up, dust yourself off, grab a support or two if you can from friends and family. You're going to need it. But don't be afraid to fail. If you fail, you fail. Okay, you failed. You know, yeah, you failed. All right. Learn from it. Don't repeat the mistakes again. Understand where you screwed up. Understand why you screwed up. Get on with trying to live. Because all you have is this one life. All you have is this one chance. Do the best you can with it. And on that note, I think I will leave off. It's been about an hour. This I hope has helped Jeff and others in his position kind of contextualize their situations and understand where and how things can go pretty spectacularly horribly wrong, and how to recover from it. Don't be afraid to fail. Don't be afraid to try something new. Don't be afraid to adjust your approach. Thank God for your tests. Thank God for testing of your faith, because ultimately you're going to find that your faith is what gets you through these problems, these hard times. And when you are through them, you will look back and you will think to yourself, huh, that didn't break me. Which means that whatever comes next won't break me either. At any rate, this has been Didactic Mind episode 35. No, 36 actually by now. Episode 36. Lessons from a complete and utter failure. Please visit my blog if you have not done so already. Links in the description box. Please visit my shaving website, Superb Shaving, where you can get the best products you will ever find for the best shave you will ever have. And you will find techniques, reviews, product links. Be sure to stop by, you know, pick up a can or two of, or I should say a tub or two of Pro Rosso shaving soap. Pick up a safety razor and some razor blades and some really good aftershave and even some pre-shave lotion if you want. Be sure to get all of that through my Amazon links, and if you order anything else off of Amazon, I also get a cut. So be sure to stop by and take advantage of all of that. You will not regret the shave that you get afterwards. If you're still using modern cartridge razors and Gillette, you know, kerosene in a can, basically, to shave according to the to their ridiculous social justice friendly "the best a man can be" campaign. If you're still doing that, just stop. Go to superbshaving.com, pick up some shaving products, and put yourself on the straight and narrow again with a proper wet razor, with a proper safety razor. This is Didact, and I will see you on the next one.